Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone tonight to Fire Engineering's Blog Talk Radio, hosted by FireEngineering.com. It's Wednesday, June 13th, 2012, and it's 1930 hours Eastern Standard Time. And you're listening to a radio show called Tap the Box, hosted by me, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. Fire and Emergency Training Consultation Services is located in Keene, New Hampshire. FETC delivers advanced level firefighter safety, survival, and leadership seminars throughout the United States. We also provide a small line of field-tested fire rescue-related equipment. So please take a moment to check out FETC Services website at www.fetcservices.com. So this show is named Tap the Box. It's a sole creation and opinion of me, the show's owner, Billy Greenwood, and FETC Services. All rights are reserved. All personal opinions expressed or implied are just that, personal opinion of me, and not that of Fire Engineering Magazine, Fire Engineering Training Blog Network, the Penwell Corporation, or any governmental agency, association, or municipal fire department for which I am associated with. With that said, and keeping all my bosses happy, we'd like to welcome callers tonight from all over the world to call into Fire Engineering Talk Radio and participate in our conversation. We only request that conversation remains cordial and professional at all times, and the toll-free number to call in and be part of the show is 1-877-497-3973. That's 877-497-3973. All right, so like I said, this is Tap the Box, and we've got a really good show for you tonight. A show that will keep firefighters safe when operating at fires. We're going to be able to talk to Fire Chief Kevin Gallagher of the Acushnet, Massachusetts Fire Department and discuss his program called Hidden Hazards of Modular Building Construction. He has had some experiences with rapid fire spread in these types of dwellings, so much so that it's become alarming to me that the fire service needs to take a serious look at this type of construction and learn how to identify, operate within, extinguish fires, and overhaul them. These buildings have some unique quirks that many firefighters and fire officers simply do not understand. So we look forward to bringing Kevin on in a few minutes, but as everyone on Tap the Box listener land knows, we here at Tap the Box like to acknowledge that we've lost some brothers over the past 30 days. We tend to take the start of our show and play a little memorial and learn from brothers who have perished in the line of duty here. So we're going to do that. So currently at 38 reported line of duty deaths for 2012, and we like to pay respect, learn, and announce those who have died over the past month. So with that said, David Wintz, Bristol, Pennsylvania. Age 65, Fire Police Captain Wintz responded to a chemical plant fire in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which was started by a lightning strike. While directing traffic at the scene, Captain Wintz started to feel ill and was taken home. He later went into cardiac arrest and was taken to the local hospital where he passed away from his apparent injuries. William Richard Daines, Bryan, Texas, age 69. Firefighter Daines passed away from an apparent heart attack while participating at training at the Teeks Grayton Fire Training Field at College Station, Texas. Ronnie Chambliss, age 40. Todd Tompkins, age 48. Missoula, Montana. Captain Todd Tompkins and First Officer Ronnie Chambliss passed away while fighting a 5,000-acre White Rock fire, which was sparked by lightning in eastern Nevada. On the second run of the day in their model P-2V Lockheed Martin aircraft, Captain Tompkins and First Officer Chambliss were nearing the wildfire when they crashed in the Hamlin Valley area of Iron County, Utah. It was estimated that the aircraft was carrying approximately 1,600 gallons of fuel and 2,000 gallons of fire retardant. Anthony Polk, Yuma, Arizona, age 31. Firefighter Polk died as a result of a single fire apparatus accident that occurred while he and two others were responding to a scene of the Montezuma fire south of Tucson, Arizona. Donald Suggs, Lillington, North Carolina, age 55. Assistant Chief Suggs had responded to an emergency call. After returning home, he collapsed at about 2100 hours that evening. He was taken to the hospital where he later passed away from an apparent heart attack. So let's take a moment and give a moment of silence to pay respect to each of these fellow brothers who made the ultimate sacrifice in the line of duty. May God and the Brotherhood take time to protect each of these men's families, friends, and fellow co-workers. Your selfless act of courage while in the act of duty to protect and serve the citizens of your community will not be forgotten. May you rest in forever peace. Godspeed. Amen. Okay, industry news. Keeping right in line with paying respect to brothers that have died in the line of duty, the United States Fire Administration has produced their 2011 summary on line of duty deaths. There were only 61 on-duty firefighter deaths in 2011, for the second consecutive year, the lowest total number since NFPA had beginning to study the numbers since 1977. The total number of deaths have been down below 100 for the six of the last 10 years. That's good for us. The average, annual average has dropped to 91 deaths per year based on the past 10 years. Although the total number of on-duty deaths have dropped significantly in each of the past 2 years, the number of cardiac-related deaths have not decreased as dramatically. The number of such deaths have been remarkably stable since 2005, with between 34 and 40 deaths annually. 31 sudden cardiac deaths in 2011 is lower than that, but still accounts for approximately 50% of the total number of deaths for 2011 as well. The number of crash deaths continue to be lower on average as well, with only 4 road vehicle crashes in 2011. This was the lowest total observed since the study began in 1977. Over the past 10 years, the number of deaths in the road vehicle crashes have averaged around 14, ranging from a low of 4 in 2011 to a high of 25 in 2003 and 2011. So the message, the life safety initiatives, the message of everyone goes home, and the training material on cardiac arrest or stress and overexertion and motor vehicle-related accidents and line-of-duty deaths are working. We need to keep close attention to that, keep focus on that, keep telling the brothers that they need to focus on that, slow down, arrive alive. In other industry news, we're glad to hear that Bladensburg, Maryland firefighter Kevin O'Toole says he has never been happier to be in a firehouse than he was last Tuesday. It was about 7:30 at night back on February 24th and an especially windy night at Prince George County, Maryland, when a fire broke out in a two-story house in Riverdale. About a dozen firefighters were battling the blaze when suddenly a strong gust of wind created a fireball inside that house, injuring seven firefighters who were on the first floor, including Kevin O'Toole. The injured firefighters were all taken to the hospital. Six of them were released within a few days, but Firefighter O'Toole was hospitalized for 8 weeks with burns over 50% of his body before he was released to go back to his parents' house in Long Island to continue his recovery. On Tuesday, Firefighter O'Toole made his first trip back to Bladensburg Firehouse, where he was reunited with a few other firefighters who were also injured at that February night fire, as they were honored by Congresswoman Donna Edwards. We here at Tap the Box would like to extend our thoughts and prayers to Firefighter O'Toole and all of the brothers who were injured that night, and we hope for a full and speedy recovery for all of you. In other industry news, I'd like to say congratulations to the brothers at Jaffrey Fire Department, a group of guys that I work with over there quite frequently. They've just completed their firefighter certification. They had a nice department badge pinning and presentation. And I'd also like to say congratulations to the Messenic High School in New Ipswich, the Messenic High School Firefighter 1 program. It's a program that's the inaugural program in high school that I was involved with, where the entire program passed with flying colors, and their graduation ceremony is coming up next week. So I'd like to say congratulations to those guys, too. All right, so like I said before, we got a really great show for you tonight, a subject that we here at FETC and Tap the Box feel is extremely important. Tonight we're going to discuss the hidden hazards of modular construction. Tonight my co-host is Kevin Gallagher. He's the fire chief of the Acushnet Fire and EMS Department in Acushnet, Massachusetts. Kevin has more than 25 years' experience as a firefighter and a chief officer. He's also an instructor for the fire science program at Bristol Community College and has an associate's degree in fire science and a bachelor's degree in political science. He has been published in Fire Engineering Magazine. He has been an FDIC instructor for multiple years. In 2010, Chief Gallagher was appointed by the governor of Massachusetts to the Board of Building Regulations and Standards Committee, the state's Building Code Oversight Board. So with that said, I'd like to welcome Chief Gallagher to Tap the Box. Let's see if I can get you on. Chief, you there?
I am, Billy. I am. Good evening to you.
Good evening to you.
Thank you. Right out of the gate, I want to thank you for the invitation to chat with you and to your listeners on an issue that I have invested some of my time and energy in over the last couple of years. I've been pushing some boulders uphill and trying to get some things done on the code front. But more importantly, and I think this ties in nicely to your opening regarding injuries and line-of-duty deaths, taking every opportunity that comes across my desk to talk about modular construction, the concerns that the fire service has with modular construction and those things that we need to let chief officers know so that they're getting that word out to their ranks, that company officers need to know in order to keep an eye out for the guys and that the men and women who are on the line going into a residential structure fire have the background and some experience on what they should be thinking differently in the event that that home is a modular. But I got to tell you, though, I've never been a co-host before. I kind of got a kick out of that introduction. I'm old enough to remember the Huntley-Brinkley news report from years back, so anytime you want to fall into the Huntley-Brinkley routine, I'll kick it back to you, David.
Very good, very good. Well, co-host or not, you've caught my eye, and I'm passionate about everything that's firefighter safety related. You know, I still like to be aggressive. I still like to go in and get it and put it out. I'm a lieutenant in the city department. I ride on the trucks. I'm in the battle with the brothers. I'm not out in the street. So my focus is on the basics, the foundation, the fundamental blocks that really keep brothers safe. And as I go through and educate and train, I keep finding that curriculums just don't have the material that I'm really looking for to provide to keep my brothers safe. And I have a passion towards this modular construction thing because I was involved with building one, GC in one, and I ideally identified firefighter safety hazards back in 2004 when I was working on this project. And then a couple years go by and I come across you with articles in Fire Engineering. You know, you're blowing it up at the FDIC conference, and it's exactly what I was going to build. But not reinvent the wheel, I decided I'm just going to make contact with you. So, you know, I appreciate everything that you're doing, and I can understand the time constraints and challenges that are involved with doing what you're doing.
This has been a real eye-opener for me in a whole bunch of different ways. But, you know, I hearken back to a quote that I read from Francis Brannigan. And, you know, I hope everyone who's listening to you just nodded out of respect to the name of Francis Brannigan, who really wrote the Bible of building construction. And his charge to us, those generations that would come after him, was to know your battleground, be it high-rises, be it hazardous material response, or, you know, the bread and butter of what we do, residential structure fires. And what I have found in sharing this information as we've acquired it and as we've fine-tuned it and identified several areas of concern, sharing that with, you know, first local firefighters and chief officers, and then kind of branching out more to the state level and then even the regional level here in New England, was that there was very little knowledge of the type of construction methods that are common to the modular industry, but brand new to us. And I've had the opportunity to talk about these concerns with representatives of the modular industry. And, you know, they kind of, you know, they look at me and they're very respectful, but they kind of shrug. And when I mention to them, you know, it might not be a good idea to have flammable glue be the only means that's holding up the ceiling. And they kind of look at me and shrug and say, you know, we don't get what the big deal is. We've been doing it for years. And what I'm finding is, you know, they know about this and they've been doing that particular building construction technique for years. But we're just finding out about it now. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why I think there's a learning curve, a very substantial gap between what that particular industry is doing, the methods that they're using, and what we would expect. I challenge anyone at 2 o'clock in the morning to roll up to a residential structure, establish command, stand at the command post, you know, do your 360 walk around on this residence with, you know, smoke pushing from a couple of windows, and be able to immediately make that determination that it's a modular. These structures are stunning. They can be simple, or they can be grand. The former fire chief in the town of Lexington, Mass. I met with him. You know, we had coffee one day, and he pointed out to me a multi-million dollar modular home in his community. I was stunned to find in Massachusetts, where we have quite a few modular homes on a regular basis, that for a certain period of time, the communities that had the most number of modulars going up were the islands, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. And it was explained to me that, you know, you try to coordinate. If you were a general contractor at one time, Billy, you know that when you're building a house, it's tough to coordinate everyone's schedules and get all the tradesmen there on time.
Absolutely.
But when a homeowner can, you know, look through a catalog and customize a wood frame home, have it arrive in modules or boxes by barge, you know, shipped to the foundation site and then assembled, and, you know, a short period of time later, be handed the keys, there's a certain attractiveness to that. And I was quite surprised to find out that Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, two communities in Massachusetts, I'll tell you that I will never be able to afford to live in, if you're familiar with our state at all. The one other concern that I have before we really get into the weeds on this is we're two New England guys, and I understand that your audience is broad-based. I have a feeling that if we stop, you know, if we really kind of punch our R's and roll our R's, we're probably going to have people scratching their head wondering, you know, what we're talking about. And I promise not to cry on your shoulder about the Red Sox. So.
Yeah, I know. I was holding up for the Celtics, but the Heat took them, you know. So,
well, as a lifelong Red Sox fan, today's what, June 13th, I can tell you that our mantra already is not beat the Yankees, but wait till next year.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of years ago, it was good to be a New England sports fan. We were winning everything. Didn't matter what sport it was. Patriots, Red Sox, Celtics won. You know, Bruins won.
Absolutely. Those were the glory days.
When you go out west to teach a class and everybody's like, you're from New England? Yeah. That's why I always had a Red Sox or a New England Patriots photo in the first slide, you know, tell everybody where I was from.
For the last few years in the presentation I've been doing down in Indianapolis for FDIC, I spend a minute or two explaining where my community is. You know, people don't know of Acushnet, Massachusetts. Maybe golfers do. At one time, we were the home of Titleist Golf Ball and cranked out bazillions of those three shifts a day for, you know, I think they only closed on Christmas Day, but for years we were the home of Titleist Golf Ball. So I use a graphic and I show where Foxborough is, and then I put up a picture of Tom Brady.
Yep.
And the room usually boos when Brady's picture goes up.
He put up his wife.
So then immediately the second photo I put up is one of his wife, and everybody applauds. So,
yeah.
You know,
everybody knows who she is.
Well, you know, who's down at FDIC but firefighters? And God bless them. They know when to boo and when to applaud.
Hey, so for the listeners out there that may not have an indication of what exactly is a modular construction home, what we've done is I've created a picture folder on Facebook on the FETC Services website. So if you go to Facebook, minimize the screen here on the radio show, and then open up another browser, and then go to Facebook and search FETC Services and hit like, or just go to the webpage, and on the very first page at the home page at the top, there's a folder called Modular Construction Radio Show, and I've got some of Chief Gallagher's really good photos in a folder here, and if you click on that, as we're talking, you'll be able to actually see exactly what we're talking about as a training aid, and I'll leave this up forever, actually, as long as the site's open, and these things will be podcasted, so if you got some brothers that are not working tonight at the house and they're working tomorrow, let them know, and then tell them exactly how they can get to these photos. But these photos are really going to say, oh, my God, I've actually been fighting fire on top of that. I can't believe this. And this is the thing that we're really going to try to stress tonight is these dwellings, the dwelling that I'm sitting in here high atop of Hurricane Hill in the city of Keene in my home office, is put together differently than a stick-built home. Okay, you're not going to find these in the inner city. You know, you're going to find them where people are building private residential homes, and like the chief had just mentioned, the luxury of it is you can sit down and customize it, and you place your order. The stuff is built inside a warehouse with engineered lumber, with no rain days, no snow days. Guys come into work for three shifts around the clock. In my house, from the first day that the saw cut a board to the day it was delivered on site was 17 days. I got a four-bedroom, two-and-a-half bath, 2,500-square-foot colonial. 17 days. And it came 90% complete. Okay? So to do that, it's not like building a stick-built home. It has some unique, what I call, quirks. And we're going to show those to you on this picture folder. So take a minute to get to Facebook and go to FETC Services Facebook page and click on Modular Construction Radio Show. So, Chief, why don't we give everybody a little bit of background? You know, the first picture that we have in that picture folder is a fire, fully involved. It's ripping. And the knowledge and background that I have, that's an occupied dwelling. That was a house that people were sleeping in, right?
Absolutely. Before I kind of paint the picture for you and tell you how I was first exposed to these concerns, I also want to make a very brief disclaimer that, you know, the statements that I make during my training presentations and in conversations with folks that call or send emails, I'm always very careful to say that those are my opinions based upon my experiences and the knowledge that my department and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has been able to pull together. It does not represent, I'm not representing the board for which I'm a member, the Board of Building Regulations and Standards. I want to make that very clear. I don't speak for the board, and my opinions aren't necessarily the opinions shared by the majority of the members or the staff of the board. So I just need to take a minute to share that with you. January 13th, 2008, the night before was my wife's 40th birthday. She will kill me once she realizes I just let Internet Land know how old she is. But it was also the night that the New England Patriots playing the Jacksonville Jaguars in a playoff game. And a family in our community in a two-year-old, two-story colonial in a very nice section of town. It's a cul-de-sac with maybe five or six similarly sized homes, had a party. They invited several friends over. The family consisted of mom and dad and two children. The party had, you know, several guests, including some other children of those who were invited. That's important in a minute. So the party's going on. The family were and are, they have rebuilt. No one was injured. Let's get that right off the top. This is not a whodunit mystery here. Everyone who was in the home was able to get out.
Safely egress.
I'm sorry?
Safely egress, correct?
Safely egress, correct. So they were not smokers, and they established the smoking area for their guests on the rear deck. They had set up some coffee cans, what I understand, filled with sand, and asked folks, if you're going to smoke, you know, smoke out there and deposit your cigarettes. At some point during the night, a couple of people who were in attendance went out onto the farmer's porch, and I need to talk to you about that in a minute. They went out onto the farmer's porch where they had a clear view of the television through the window, and smoked a cigarette. And when the person was done with that cigarette, they deposited the cigarette butt into a window box that were stacked up. Remember, this is January. Here in New England, nothing grows outside in January. So they had five or six peat moss-filled window boxes stacked one on top of each other. The cigarette went in there, and the party went back into the house. So based upon the investigation conducted by the state fire marshal and a subsequent investigation in review that are concurrent, I should say, that we conducted with the assistance of others, we determined that the origin of the fire was in that window box, and the cause was the careless disposal of smoking material. So the party broke up after midnight. Folks went home. Two additional children stayed for the night, so there was a total of six humans in that home, along with a dog. At some point during the night, early morning, the wife worked an early morning shift. So her body clock kind of woke her up very early, even on days off. And she woke up early and just noticed that the room was warmer than usual, kind of exceptionally warm. And she kicked off the bed covers and, you know, continued to feel the sensation of heat. And she woke up her husband and, you know, kind of told him, hey, wake up, the room is really warm. And, you know, being, A, having watched the Patriots win late night party, and it being a weekend, I'm sure he just kind of grumbled and rolled over, which is what my response would have been. But she got up, and she walked around the bedroom, and she looked out the A side, and she noticed that the roof of the farmer's porch was on fire. So, you know, she screamed. She alerted her husband. They had the time to get dressed. They woke up the four children who were in the house, got them dressed, found the dog, found a leash to, you know, clip to the dog. All this time, the fire was burning, and there was nothing in the house. Smoke detectors were not sounding. There was no indication that the fire had penetrated into the home. The husband told me that he brought everybody down the stairs. The stairs deposited them at the front door. He opened the front door and had the fire burning above his head in the farmer's porch roof. He later claimed he really doesn't know what he was thinking, but it took a nanosecond for him to just shove the kids out, and he and his wife and the dog, like he told me, maybe 1 or 2 feet actually touched the porch as they bolted. They got across this. They made it away across their front lawn, all safely exited. The husband turned, and the fire at that time was consuming the roof of the farmer's porch and slowly starting to make its way above the roof line of the farmer's porch on the A side. If you're looking at the photo, it would be to the left of the farmer's porch roof. Now, when I have talked about this fire in the past, I've done it at a meeting at the NFPA that the Research Institute put together very early in this process. The room was filled with gentlemen in Brooks Brothers suits and briefcases. I kind of knew right then that I was outgunned. I made the presentation, and then the lawyers and the lobbyists and the scientists that the industry brought into that room really kind of started to tear away at the story. And, you know, kind of point out different issues that I thought was of concern, that they just were, gave me the impression that they were rather dismissive of. The husband did leave the front door open. Want to say that right up front. The farmer's porch was illegally attached. They did not pull a building permit for that farmer's porch. So there are some issues. This is not a lily white rendition of a fire here. There were some concerns separate and above the structure being a modular fire.
Okay.
So now the husband, and Billy, if I start going on too long about this fire, give me a verbal kick to get it going. But
okay.
I think it's important just to understand, you know, how the hook was set for us. So the husband had the time to attempt to grab a garden hose that was still attached, and he was trying to put some fire on it. So even though the fire was consuming the roof, you know, he was making a brave effort at trying to knock it down. The rest of the family made it halfway across the street. They were met by neighbors who said, "We've already contacted 911. So as far as I'm concerned, the clock starts then, because now we've got time stamp on when the call came in. The police department, per the SOP, notifies the fire department and our firefighters dispatched the appropriate companies, and we began our response. At the same time, the police department notified one of the cruisers in the area to make their way that way. When the officer reached within less than a minute of that call being received, he had heavy, thick smoke and fire seen above the tree lines. This officer was, like most really smart police officers, began his career as a call firefighter. Worked with us, and he, within 4 minutes of his dispatch to the scene, he arrives and announces that the structure is 75% involved.
Wow.
And I think it's important to know that he had some experience under his belt. You know, he wasn't just guessing here. He had some training.
Yep.
When I was driving there, I also saw a ball of flame. Probably quarter of a mile, if not a little further, above the tree line. Even before arriving, I contacted dispatch and asked them to get the investigators from the fire marshal's office out, because my experience and my gut told me that a fire of that magnitude that quickly had to be assisted by the hand of man.
Yeah.
So let's get the investigators moving as quickly as possible. So all this was going down around 6:15, 6:30 in the morning. Some of the photos that you're looking at, when our guys arrived, that's what they saw. And the house was fully involved. There's one photo. I'm sure when you go around talking to different departments, prior to formalized SOPs, we were seeing on the fire ground a lot of guys bring in their cell phones with cameras.
Yep.
And, you know, I didn't really have a good handle on this. And, you know, there wasn't really a lot of literature out there. All I knew was that this was something new. And as, you know, someone who is fortunate enough to be a chief officer, if something's new, our immediate response is stop it, don't do it. Wait until we get our heads around this before you start taking photos. I am really glad that my guys broke that rule with this particular fire. We have one, a photograph taken from side B that shows the two cars in the driveway, and you see the lights of the police cruiser off to the side. This is before any of the fire apparatus arrived. And if you see that picture, and if I can just describe it, there is fire equally distributed, both on the first level and the second level.
Yeah, front to back, too.
In front to back, up and down, inside and out. This place was roaring, like a fire that, you know, it's one of those fires where you really think that, again, somebody helped this out.
Yeah, well, traditional building construction, and when you have a fire that gets a jump on you that far in advance in an occupied dwelling, traditionally, if you look at the history of the fire service, it was either an arson job internally or someone was trying to kill a family and they lit the fire from the exterior, pour gasoline on the door or
right.
on the stairway, you know. So those are all red flags that you know, pull a card out of your Rolodex in your head and go, you know, something's wrong here. And it turned out to be, you know, not that, but it also red flagged that there was something wrong and there was other additional factors. So, you know, don't be hesitant to say that, you know, something was wrong, because it truly was, you know.
It was. And I, you know, I want to modify that statement. I think the hand of man was involved with how fast this fire burned, just not the way that I was thinking about it at 7 o'clock in the morning,
right.
That January morning.
Yep.
So, you know, I made probably the most insightful and decisive decision I have ever made when I arrived on scene and assumed command. I announced that this would be a defensive operation. That was honestly the easiest decision I think I've ever made. We set up a collapse zone and, you know, master streams and watched for exposures. It was set back from the property, from the tree line, and from any other neighbors. So we did have some, you know, flying embers, but we were able to keep an eye on that. So, you know, we literally stood there, dumped as much water on it as we could. We did have water relay issues. We were about 900 feet from the closest hydrant. We laid a 4-inch supply line. We had a little bit of difficulty getting a pumper in the middle to assist with moving the water along. But there was nothing, and that, by the way, was all picked up by the lawyers and scientists from the industry when they came to tear this whole issue apart back at the NFPA in the early days, that somehow I found myself at that meeting, surprisingly, I was completely unprepared for this, defending my department.
Defending your water supply?
Defending my guys, that somehow or another this fire burned and consumed every single thing that this family owned because of us. And, you know, my Irish temper got the best of me. And I had to sit on my hands because the photographs that you see were prior to our arrival.
Yeah.
Guys, you know what, none of my guys got hurt at this fire. That's the most important thing. There was every possibility of this crazy fire getting even crazier. But, you know, we were able to keep it contained to the foundation upon which it stood, which was all our best hope is that this didn't spread. So, you know, to get dusted up a little bit over decisions that we made or issues that we had with water supply were absolutely irrelevant and, you know, not uncommon to anyone that is being challenged, you know, kind of used as an opportunity to block or distract or, you know, kind of push you off and make you go away.
Right.
But so, you know, I got to tell you, the I had been chief for about 4 years at that point, and we don't have many structure fires in the course of a year on our department. Between fire and EMS, we're probably, you know, around 1,100, 1,200 calls a year. Like everyone else, the vast majority of ours are medical. The structure fires that we get are few and far between when we get them. The guys work exceptionally well for a combination department. with the equipment and apparatus that we have. They do a tremendous job. There was just no way we were going to beat this one.
No, the cards were dealt before you guys arrived.
Exactly. Yep. So, very good segue. Very, very good segue. So, you know, the next day we started our investigation. And, that was the Sunday. So Monday we rolled in. First person I went to see was the building inspector, and he came over with the blueprints for the house. We rolled it out, and, you know, he said, well, it's a modular. And prior to that, I didn't know much about modulars. Like other small-town chiefs, a lot of us do our own inspections, do them with the guys, and we're required upon sale or transfer of a property to go in and check, you know, for the operation and placement of smoke detectors. And we'd go in, and sometimes modulars would be a little funky because the detectors weren't exactly where we used to see them in the stick-built home, and we'd have to address that. But besides that, I knew that they traveled over the road and that, you know, one day there was an empty house lot, and a couple of days later there was a beautiful home there. That was really the extent of what I knew. I will tell you one quick story. You mentioned that I have a bachelor's degree in political science, which I do from the University of Massachusetts here down the South Coast in Dartmouth. And in another life, prior to going into the fire service, I had the great opportunity to work with some of our local politicians back when politicians were considered to be honorable folks, not like today where they're run out of town with torches and pitchforks behind them. And one of the elected officials that I got to meet and assist on a couple of his campaigns is Jim Shannon, who is the president of the NFPA. And, again, I'm a local guy. NFPA to me means Fire Prevention Week, or meant to me was Fire Prevention Week. And, you know, I used to pick up the phone and call the 800 number and spend the $400 on a video, like other departments do. And I just thought that this fire needed to be reported and at least some level of investigation or research on whether or not this, you know, was just indicative of fires when they hit modular homes, or is this something, you know, I was expecting to get a call back from a researcher at the NFPA and say, yeah, we know that. And I said, okay, good, well, just chalk this one up, you know, to what you already know. And when I called the NFPA, all I had was the 800 number for their order line. And I ended up calling the administrative office, and the person who answered the phone, I used that hook. You know, Mr. Shannon doesn't know me, but, you know, back in the 80s when he ran for the U.S. Senate, you know, I used to walk through diners with him in New Bedford, you know, having him shake people's hands. And this woman was very, very kind. She said, well, hold on for a minute. And I fully expected her to give me somebody's phone number. And Jim Shannon picked up the phone. And we talked, and I explained to him, you know, what we had. And the next day or the day shortly thereafter, Bob Duvall, who's the lead investigator for the NFPA, came down to Acushnet, and we brought him out to the fire scene, and which was still standing. The remains of the building was still standing. And he did a walkthrough, and then we sat down in the station, looked over the blueprints, and he kind of pointed out one or two things that really got this thing going.
Okay. Well, that's a great background. It's a good lead in to people look at these photos. And then I got my sound guys, Mark and Rich, telling me you sounded good. You're sounding good, so we're good there. Let's talk a little bit about what a modular is. So we've got a lot of people in listener land that don't really know maybe what a modular is. So background-wise, there's a difference between a modular home and a mobile home, okay? So mobile home arrives on axles and wheels affixed to that structure, so it's essentially a mobile trailer. It gets placed on blocks or on a pad. They take the wheels off it. They skirt it. Okay, that's a mobile home. Modular home is a prefabricated home. For the people that are listening to their land, it comes, like the chief said, freighted either on barge or on trailer. It's not meant to go over the road. It's not designed to be traveled over the road as a trailer. It's a fixed box loaded on a trailer that's designed for the road. So there's the difference between mobile and modular. Okay, and if you're looking at the photos here in the Facebook folder, the fourth photo is a typical residential modular home with a farmer's porch. Not necessarily the one that shows in the previous ones. We're just showing you some examples. And then if you move to the fifth one, you're looking at multiple family or residential for apartment building or townhouse. And then in the sixth one, we're looking at a commercial occupancy. So these are not just one-story ranches, which most people, when you talk to them, the first thing that comes to mind is a single-story ranch or a single-story prefab double-wide. And they're not. These things range from a small-scale ranch all the way to a McMansion, you know, 3, 4, 5,000 square feet residential homes. And in the process of developing those, they've created some unique building construction design that would be different than a stick-built home to span the areas that they need to span. Now, we all understand in our firefighter building construction class that the emphasis now on lightweight construction is key. Really thin, really lightweight, might be actually chips that are all ground together with glue for press board. And now they're engineering lightweight beams, whether they're TGI or box truss. The thing with these is key. The key to these is that when we look at these lightweight engineered trusses or beams, to span a certain gap, a short gap, they're not very tall. They could be 6 inches in height, similar to a 2x6 in dimension and height. But when you go to span them, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet, the engineered beam manufacturers can span that. What they have to do in the engineering design, though, is engineer what the weight load is, engineer over the distance that it needs to travel, and then engineer into the actual beam design what the clearances need to be to tolerate the weight or the load. And when you start to span wide gaps, the beam itself starts to get taller. So instead of a 2x10 or a 2x12, if you're spanning a wide gap, you might actually have a TGI beam that is 16, 18, 20 inches tall. Now, that's just one beam, and when you put that on a sill and then you put the floor on top of it, you now have a void that is much, much larger than a traditional 2x10 or a 2x12. That's just one facet. The other facet is in the modular construction, we're stacking boxes. These boxes are engineered in the factory to go over the road, and if they were put together by 2x4s, when they arrived on the job site, they would be all twisted, and all the sheetrock would be cracked and ripped. And they come, you know, I'll say 75% complete. So if you order a kitchen, your cabinets are in, your countertops are in, the sinks are in, the baseboard heating is in, the registers are in, the plumbing is in. Each box has a junction point for electrical and for plumbing, where it's going to meet and mate up to the next box, whether it's side by side or up and down. For those boxes to arrive with rigidity, you have 2x6 walls, you can get 2x10 or 2x12 floors, and 2x6 ceiling joists, okay, above you in each box. So a first floor box is 2x6 all the way around, and whatever you order for a floor, 2x10 or 2x12, some manufacturers, if they're spanning a great distance, will stack that 2x10 floor joist on top of an engineered beam because they're spanning a large distance because someone wants to have a great room in the basement where they don't want lolly columns. Okay, steel posts where you thread them and spin them up, and it puts tension on the bottom to create a beam at a certain distance throughout a home. Traditional stick-built homes have lolly columns. Most everybody in listening land should know that. What we're seeing is people want to create large gap spans. To do that, they're using engineered beams. They're not putting the engineered beams into the box. Those don't create the rigidity to go over the road. The boxes are built with solid mass wood, 2x6, 2x10, or 2x12s. Okay? So when you stack that box on a regular sill of a foundation and you're not spanning a large distance, you just have the regular 2x10 floor joists. Now, when you go to stack the next box for the second floor on top of, let's say, a colonial or a two-story cape, the ceiling of the first floor box is a 2x6, but the box that comes and gets stacked on top is built the exact same way the first floor box is because the jigs are made that way. So that means that the floor on the second floor box is going to have either a 2x10 or a 2x12 floor joist stacked on top of a 2x6. When you stack the mass together, you now have either 16 inches or greater of void space in that ceiling area. So I just want to point out that the way that the construction is made between a stick-built home and a modular home, there's more wood mass, lightweight wood mass, kiln-dried wood, in a modular home. And if you're looking at fuel loads and you're looking at rapid fire spread, lightweight engineered wood is kindling at a campfire. Once it gets going, when the dwelling and the structural support of that building gets going, it is not solid mass dimensional lumber of the old days. So our numbers are all going to be different from a tactics standpoint. So we'll get to the tactics part in a minute. But getting back to the pictures, we'll have the chief pick up here, and he's got some great photos of void spaces. And if you're looking in the folder, we're up to like we're up to number 7. And that's a ceiling void space, and you can see that the plumbing, the wiring, and the glue, okay, this is coming up here. So go ahead, Chief, pick up right there.
Well, Billy, that was an extremely thorough and comprehensive description and spoken by someone with a great deal of experience. I was sitting here taking notes, as a matter of fact. The lines sometimes blur in people's minds, but it needs to really be much clearer. There is a very big distinction between a manufactured home and a manufactured building. As you mentioned, manufactured homes are those on chassis. Typically, we think of them as mobile homes, and they're governed by HUD regulations. The manufactured buildings are what we're talking about, the modular structures, the stick-built that are built in factories. As you said earlier, in ideal weather conditions, there's usually a 14 or 15 step process in different staging areas where the construction begins on a platform on wheels in one corner, and when it makes it out the back end of the factory, it's a module ready to be assembled on a foundation. And I've had the opportunity to go to Maine and tour one of the New England manufacturers, and it's quite the process. Henry Ford would be very proud of this. It's truly an assembly line process, and it's built there in the factory. And like you said, everything is there. You know, they show up with the carpet already laid, and they, like you said, the baseboard, all the fixtures. The recessed lighting the bulbs are in the recessed lighting, and very importantly, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, I hope, they're inspected at the factory as well. And where a local building inspector would oversee by several visits to the construction site for a traditionally stick-built home, in the manufactured home process, those inspections occur at the factory by an entity called a third-party inspection agency.
Yep.
Who is in the employ of the manufacturer. And they set up a system of inspections and quality review of the quality control programs. They may not be in the building during the entire construction of that module, but it's their responsibility to make sure that the structure is built to the code of the state in which it is being shipped to. And then, like you said, these modules, the one that burned in my town and the one that we have several pictures of online, four boxes, shrink wrapped and put on flatbeds and transported from wherever they were built to my town here, lifted off by cranes, set on the foundation, and then the last piece of this, and this is a critical component, is that it is assembled by a set crew, by a local group of contractors who have been hired by the company to assemble these homes. And there's There's some responsibilities that I think lie at the feet of the manufacturers, and then some responsibility that lies at the feet of the set crew. But we need to understand that they're separate units when they arrive in your community. They are then assembled, and it's that assembly process that can also cause some issues that would be of concern for us. And then remember, the local building official, you know, he rolls in and looks for the stamp, looks for the sticker that says this has been approved before it was shipped out. And, you know, obviously they've done foundation inspections, and there'll be a wiring inspection and plumbing inspection, and then a final inspection. But the number, compared to the number of inspections that are done on a stick-built home by local people who are held, you know, accountable by local townspeople or city councils or boards of selectmen, those, the vast majority of those inspections are being done by inspectors in the factory who are in the employ of the manufacturers.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I, for one, just have a hard time, you know, with that concept. You know, I'm sure it is legitimate. I'm sure it is defendable. But on first blush, you know, they are inspecting the product of the folks that have hired them. And there's not many of them, from what I understand, in the country. But I will tell you that at yesterday's BBRS meeting in Boston, one of our members, we've been looking at manufactured homes for a while now, one of our members took it upon himself to do a surprise inspection in Pennsylvania of three manufacturers, and he came back with a glowing report. He thought that the processes were solid, the quality control program was in place and being followed, and that the products that were being shipped to Massachusetts with our own unique code requirements that have been recently enacted is being followed. And, you know, he kind of gave him a glowing report. And we're happy about that. You know, we don't want these guys to fail. This is not a pair of shoes that a homeowner in your community is buying. This is, for most people, for most of us, this is the most significant investment that we will make. And I think all of us should be very pleased that when it's leaving the factory, and in most parts, when it's assembled by the set crew in your community, it is a quality product. But we go back to those techniques that they use that are common to them, problematic to us. So the first one that you brought up is the void space. The photograph that hopefully folks are looking at on Facebook, and I'll try to describe for those who are not, is looking down into the ceiling assembly of the first floor box. In the photographs that you're looking at under construction was a four-box colonial. And what you see is a lot of the, like you said, the utilities, the electrical, some plumbing, and insulation scattered here or there. But what is important to see is that the ceiling joists are supporting the sheetrock ceiling. Okay, so that's part A of this mystery. And then if you look at, I believe it's the next photo, further down, we have a photograph of the underside of the second floor box, and that has its own support assembly. That has its own floor joists. So in this case, we should have seen this coming. We should have figured this out as a service. This really shouldn't have come as much as a surprise as it is to us, that if you have a first floor box that has its ceiling already assembled and the joists, you know, laid out, and then you lay upon it a second floor box that is going to, you know, match up on the perimeter, that you're going to have a void between the ceiling of the first floor and the second floor decking. What is surprising is that in most cases, it's 20 inches high. So that box, which generally I am told is built to the dimensions that can be safely transported over the road, which is usually 48 feet thereabouts long, 14 feet wide or thereabouts, we have a void now in that first floor, second floor assembly of 48 feet by 14 feet by 20 inches high. And you know, when I've shared this information with folks, they've kind of looked and said, well, you know, that's balloon construction on the horizontal plane.
Yeah, laying sideways.
Absolutely. You know, 672
square feet.
they've just taken balloon construction that, you know, would run from the attic to the basement. I grew up in a home in the city of New Bedford that was balloon construction. And, you know, my brothers and I used to drive my mother crazy when she was in the basement ironing our uniforms for school. We'd go up in the attic and, you know, drop coins. And they would bounce at her feet, and she would just get, you know, very upset with us. But this is something similar now. We've just picked that up and laid it sideways, and we're saying we're okay with that.
One of the things I want to point, Chief, out, and I've seen it firsthand, just as you have, but before it burnt, is that if you look at the ceiling joists, which are holding the ceiling up, like you said in that first slide, they're on 24 on center. And if you look at the way the floor joists are laid out for the second floor box, they're laid on 16 on center. So if the boxes are made in a jig and the ends of the boxes butt up perfectly at the sills, every one of those joists, whether it's the ceiling or the floor in that void space, the actual wood doesn't match up to create a bay like you would have if
Correct.
You laid out a regular floor joist. So now we have the capability of this puzzle where it goes up and down and up and down over the 2x6 and then down underneath the 2x10, and it goes the span of 48 feet, like you said, to get that lateral spread. But you also have that upwards to 20-inch horizontal void space as well, which is running all the utilities there. If you look at the photo, you can see that everything's laid in there. And now you have the possibility of having electrical problem in a void space underneath the floor, if you're on the second floor or above you in the first floor. And if we back up one photo, looking down at the top of that first floor box, you can see the glue that's sprayed in underneath the 2x6 that is holding the sheetrock up in the ceiling of the first floor. So now we have a fire in the void, and it has an additional fuel load of this adhesive glue.
Billy, the issue for me with the void space, and I've poked my head into over a dozen modular homes with flashlights and you know, cameras to take photographs. This is a mini cock loft. We're not talking a small little void. This is significant. And, you're right, if you do the math, you know, length times width, you're coming up with 672 square feet. And that's important because when you look at the code, the international residential code that so many of us are using these days, draft stopping, some form of barrier that's designed by the code, it's specified in the code, that would slow the spread of smoke and superheated gases and air,
yep,
is only required in void spaces of over 1,000 square feet.
Ah.
So we've asked the question, who came up with that formula? Where 1,000 square feet, if you look at, 48 by 14 by 20 inches high, that 672 square feet is significant. And, my concern is in a, let's take a sofa fire in the living room. You come in the front door and the living room is off to your left. You know, if that fire gets up into the void space, and we'll talk about how easily it can in a minute, I'm now concerned about what's happening above my head 48 feet in the opposite direction.
Exactly.
Because there's no draft stopping there. So we put together a code change proposal for the ICC. We went down to Baltimore. This was the meeting where the fire service came to reaffirm the vote on residential sprinklers. The place was packed. There were more firefighters there than I think I've ever seen on the one roof. The night was long. We willingly gave up our spot in line for a proposal that would cut the requirement for draft stopping to 500 square feet. And we passed it so that we put it at the end of the agenda so sprinklers could come up sooner. Unfortunately, after the sprinkler vote, the chair gaveled the meeting to an end. The next morning, nobody was in the room when the proposal came up, and it went down in defeat. However, the feedback that we received from the ICC members was that we cast too wide of a net, and that simply saying of any void space in excess of 500 square feet, 1,000 square feet needed to be cut in half. probably captured some construction that we didn't intend. So we have a proposal slowly making its way through the Massachusetts process that would do just that. However, what we learned from the Baltimore experience, we fine-tuned it to say that in void spaces that are created by a ceiling membrane above that is held in place by a structural member separate and distinct from the structural member that's holding the floor membrane above. I'm sorry, the ceiling below and the floor membrane above, supported by two different joists. In those type of void spaces, then the draft stopping needs to kick in at 500 square feet.
So it's specific to modular.
Specific, and that's what the industry said. The industry said, hey, wait a minute, you're picking on us. This is only going to affect us. And my response was, you think? This is what we want. We want in this cavern that is filled with other things that has us concerned, some sort of barrier that stops the spread of superheated air, fire. It's not going to put the fire out, but it slow it down to the point where the occupants would have an opportunity to exit the building, hopefully have a safe haven to make it down the stairs if the fire started on either side, and that our guys, when they come in to put out that sofa fire, you don't have ceiling collapsing on them 48 feet, to their right. So that's slowly making its way through.
One of the things that jumps out at me, geez, sorry for stepping on there, was in that 20 or 22 or 24 inch void space, depending upon what you chose for lumber or joists. If we were looking at, like, back at slide 5, where you're in a multi-family residential apartment building, which is being built in the stick-built world, if you had that same void space, one, the building would be sprinklered, but the void space would have to have not only a drop for the occupancy in each apartment, but it would also have to have a tee going up into the void space to protect that void. And I can't remember if the code is by height or if it's by total width for square footage, but I've seen that pretty commonly now where the sprinkler companies are doing both. They're tapping a tee off of to do both, the void and to the occupancy below.
The industry didn't like this proposal of draft stopping. And, they came and testified against it, in opposition to it. But they asked one of their member manufacturing companies to engineer this out, to look at ways that they would recommend that the draft stopping be put in place, and come up with a cost so that we can make a cost estimate, because everything is driven by cost these days. And they got back to us, and the document that they gave us, I was thankful for. It said that it's a pretty easy fix and isn't a engineering challenge, and the cost would be $350 per draft stopping. So for a total of $700 additional dollars, you would have draft stopping in the void space. Because remember, we're talking, the way I explain it is it's four boxes, front A and B, rear A and B, and where those two top boxes sit on those two lower boxes, you're going to have two separate and distinct void spaces. And so the fix apparently is not a challenge. It's not landing men on the moon here. And for $350 per, $700 total or thereabouts, I think it would give us that we could relax a little bit more if there is a fire in that void space, knowing that something is going to slow the spread of the superheated air, the superheated gases, so that when we get there, we might not have as difficult a challenge as if it's owning that entire void space.
Yeah, so absolutely. When I look at, getting an occupancy permit, and we go out oftentimes to do inspections with the fire inspection department, and oftentimes we're out doing cistern inspection and testing because in our community we're allowed to have private cisterns as well, instead of residential sprinkler for a certain size home, depending upon the code that's currently in place in development-wise. So oftentimes we'll go out with an engine company and we'll pump the cistern before they sign off on the CO. And I'll ask the homeowner, what was your decision for putting the cistern in the ground versus putting a sprinkler system in your home? And oftentimes it comes down to the almighty dollar. And I say to them, that's great, but the water that's sitting in the ground out there is just waiting for the fire department to arrive. It's going to do you absolutely no good prior to arrival, like your first three photos. I said, I built the house, I put a residential sprinkler system in it myself, and I have a firefighter on duty 24 hours a day, and it's gonna have a quick action release, and it's going to have immediate suppression on an early incipient stage fire. I might have some water damage, sure, absolutely, but nowhere near the damage that's going to occur waiting for the arrival, even at the bestest fire department with the greatest times and the full complement of personnel, 100% full-time, doesn't matter. That's still going to incur more damage than what could occur with the water damage side of a residential sprinkler, as long as the system's in place, it's correct, it's approved and certified and tested. So I then ask people, a challenge, well, did you get a quote on the sprinkler system? And they'll tell me, yeah, geez, this is $5,000 or $7,500, depending upon the square footage of their home. And in reality, if you do get a chance to walk through the home, you'll walk through the kitchen and say, geez, how much did you pay for these granite countertops?
Right.
And the sprinkler system at times is the same price as some of the upgrades that people choose to put in their homes on the initial build. Whereas if you choose to pick, a Corian countertop or just a laminate countertop, you can always upgrade those later and not have the demolition of upgrading a sprinkler system because you decide to put it in later on. And it's pennies on the dollar. It's, I think, pennies on the dollar. So if you're looking at someone building a $500,000 home and they're not interested in spending $10,000 for a $500,000 home on a sprinkler system or $5,000 on a $200,000 home, it's minor in the percentage game of what that can provide for life safety. And everybody always falls back on it. It never happened to me. But it's just amazing that that people will look at that as it'll never happen to me, but they'll still put in whatever's the bare minimum to meet the requirement to satisfy the occupancy permit.
And we could go on for 3 hours on residential sprinklers, but I had a very difficult St. Valentine's Day this year when the board of which I am a member opted not to include in the code a provision that was put forward by our very progressive state fire marshal, Steve Cohen, that Massachusetts, by the way, adopted the ICC codes, including the IRC, but we kicked out the residential sprinkler requirement. And the marshal then submitted for our review and consideration a proposal that would have set the NFPA as the standard, but allowed each municipality to opt in. It's called a stretch code. Mm-hmm. And we regrettably, over the vote of the Fire Chiefs Association of the Commonwealth that I represent on that board and the state fire marshal, the board voted against that proposal. So in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, unless you are building a home, a single-family home of over 14,000 square feet, there's no requirement for residential sprinklers.
Wow.
So if you're building a McMansion, you're safe. If you're building a house that you and I are going to live in, not so much. So
wow.
It's a head-scratcher. It's frustrating as all get out when you come up against the home builders and others. That's a fight for a different day. But I'm not sure how much time we have, Billy, but what I really want to kind of drill into now, if it's okay with you, is the glue. Because
yes.
To me, that was the most surprising, the most frustrating, the most hit your head against the desk and say, are you kidding me moment that we had in this whole ordeal.
Yes, talk about the glue, absolutely.
Polyurethane foam structural adhesive. It is a Gorilla glue. It is a foaming sprayed-on glue that's used in that assembly line process. The way that the ceiling, it's used in ceiling applications and partition walls, non-load-bearing walls. So in the factory, the sheetrock will be laid out. The frame for the ceiling, which has already been built, will be laid upon the sheetrock, and an employee with a high-pressured gun will spray a bead of glue along one side of the joist. That glue will then foam up where the sheetrock, where two pieces of sheetrock are supported by the same joist, they spray on both sides. The glue is designed to adhere to the wood joist in the back paper of the sheetrock. It's not attaching, it's not underneath, it's not designed to be underneath the joist and be between the sheetrock and the wood. The wood is laid flush on the sheetrock, and a fillet bead, if you will, is laid down. So the bonding that's happening is simply a marriage via the glue between a small portion of the wood and the back paper of the sheetrock. Why is that of concern? Well, traditionally, sheetrock is attached to structural members via a screw. And with folks that I've talked to who are a lot smarter than I am about this, the full capability of the sheetrock, for sheetrock to do what sheetrock is designed to do, it should be hung with the screw biting into and incorporating all three components of sheetrock. Now, I never knew there were three components of sheetrock, but there is. There's the front paper, the core, and the back paper.
Mm-hmm.
And when all three of those are employed and anchored into a structural member, then sheetrock can be proclaimed to, you know, to be in a position to do what it is designed to do. But here the industry has been allowed, through the codes, to use glue exclusively as the sole means for attaching ceiling to supporting structure. And I will tell you that I'm not too sure that they're, you know, that that's widely known among members of the fire service.
No, especially not in people who are doing inspections, because I think, at least what I find, is most of them think that that's just spray, overspray from when they spray the face of the actual joist or the board and then put the sheetrock on, and it's just what squeezes out when they push it on.
Right.
And it's not. The board's laid on flush, and they spray it from the back to create kind of like a triangle on each side mm-hmm. of the joist to adhere and bond everything together in like this concave fashion, and that creates a ton of fuel load in that bay.
But let's talk about that for a minute. Let's just back up a little bit. This is code compliant. You know, this the industry isn't doing anything in defiance of the codes. The code says that, you know, you attach it. It lays out a schedule for mechanical fasteners based upon the size of the thickness of the sheetrock, and it will give you the size of the screws and how far they're supposed to be spaced. And that schedule says if you're using structural glue, then you can cheat on the number of screws. You can spread them out even further because you have two different mechanisms of securing the sheetrock. However, it doesn't say anything about using glue alone. So we investigated that with the ICC, and you know what their response was is, yes, you're right. You can't use it. The code is written where you have to use both. However, there is a section of the code in the administrative chapter that says that alternative methods and designs of construction techniques can be used if that alternative method is found to have the same capabilities and characteristics of what it's designed to replace. And it's been explained to me that, you know, there's a 3-year cycle with the I-codes, and if you and I invent something that is, you know, just the whiz-bang construction method or a new way of attaching whatever, we should not have to wait 3 full years before the industry can use that. If we pass certain tests, then it can be used and inserted into the construction process via this alternative methods and design clause, which to me sounds sensible. But when we look at the justification for using this, the modular industry was pretty quick to point to a certain ASTM standard that does test you know, I think there's 15 or so, I don't have the notes in front of me, 15 different tests that this product needed to pass. And it passed all of them, but none of them were under high heat conditions. None of the tests that it had to pass in order to replace mechanical fasteners alone had anything to do with high temperatures to see how long will this glue continue to do what glue does when the room is burning below. So we took samples of this glue. We did a little, you know, back of the fire station test. You know, held it with a pair of pliers because, you know, it kind of cuts off. So we had a pretty long bead of this. We cut it off. We put a match to it, and it just went up.
Some pictures in the folder.
Yeah, this is, you know, it's polyurethane. This stuff is going to be it's petroleum based. So we sent samples along to very, very good people over at WPI, Worcester Polytechnic Institute, that has a wonderful fire science and fire engineering program. And one of the doctors there did kind of basic tests for us, and the report came back that this stuff, you know, burns fast, it burns hot, it burns thoroughly, it loses a lot of its mass. And, you know, that's of concern because that's what's holding up the ceiling, and that's what's filling this void space. So they did an additional round of tests, you know, with using some other scientific equipment, and what they determined was that the glue starts to decompose. It's changing its chemical makeup. It's moving from a solid to a gas. At 250 degrees Celsius, or 482 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, when we got that data back, you know, I almost fell out of my chair, because we've been teaching our guys, you've been teaching your guys, we've all had this assumption that, you know, the ceiling temperature in a room and contents fire is going to be how hot? Hot.
Yeah, you know, 1,000 degrees.
Let's just agree. We'll for the benefit of the doubt and to err on the side of being conservative here, let's just say it's 1,000 degrees at the ceiling level. So we're talking about 48.2% of that heat transferring through the sheetrock before the glue that's holding it in place above starts to chemically change from a solid to a gas. And the report back also said that, you know, similarly, they would expect the mechanical strength, the mechanical capabilities of the glue to begin to decompose when that chemical decomposition begins. So when we got this, we brought it to the board and said, you know, come on, guys, we got to focus in on this. And the industry, well, we then put forward a code change proposal in Massachusetts that said, you know what, we're going to close that loophole. We're going to close that loophole that says the alternative methods of using glue alone is allowed. So we put forth a code change proposal that said if you are using glue, you are going to use the mechanical fastener schedule as found in the residential code. And that passed. And that's now part of the Massachusetts front-end amendments, the unique amendments to the Massachusetts Building Code. And we're very proud of that. That was a good success for the fire service to get that into our code, and we're attempting to get it in because the industry has responded. One of the factories that my fellow board member visited a couple of weeks ago down in Pennsylvania and reported to us yesterday is, you know, they decided, well, if we're going to have to rejig here and reconfigure our processes to comply with this unique Massachusetts code, then damn it, let's just do it for all the modules that we sell. Others are still doing it just for the modules that come into the Commonwealth. There's been some manufacturers that company up in Maine that I referenced earlier that stopped using glue altogether. When this stuff started hitting locally and when the local media got involved with it, the owner of the company, the general manager, told me that they went out into their factory yard with a piece of this dried glue. They lit it on fire, and they were stunned at how quickly it burned.
Yeah.
And, you know, they said they saw the handwriting on the wall and decided to get out of using the glue, and they've gone now with just mechanical fasteners, and it works for them. They're not getting the negative feedback from their customers. Remember, the industry will tell you that they move to glue only because when you put a box on a flatbed and you travel it from Pennsylvania to New Hampshire, and the amount of vibration that it suffers, they would have an awful lot of pop-throughs with the screws that would then cost them money on the setup portion of this by having to go in there and repair them.
Right.
So, you know, they got the glue, and the glue greatly reduced the stress and therefore the fractures that they had to go and take care of. So it is being done. It's being addressed. The industry, before the code was put forward, and I don't mean to beat them up, but, you know, it was frustrating at times. They asked for a timeout before the code went into effect, and they said, allow us to do the testing. We concede that there's no data available on what temperature the ceiling fails or how the fire spreads inside of a void space. So they pledged to us that they would take it upon themselves as an industry to hire a reputable independent laboratory to do those two tests. They sent us the testing parameters. We polished those up and sent them back and said, okay, you get us that data. What we're saying pretty much is prove us wrong. We have this theory. We've seen it in a couple of different fires where it wasn't filmed, so we don't know exactly what happened. It wasn't a NIST, you know, stage fire with 20 different cameras and thermal couplings measuring. But we have a pretty good assumption that the failure of the glue is what destroyed the home in my community so quickly, and one in Hanson, Mass. So quickly, and one in other states that, you know, we've been able to investigate. And they said, give us the time to do that. And then they asked for some more time, and they asked for some more time. And the day before the meeting in which we enacted this code change, they sent us a letter saying, you know, we don't have the testing data. We don't have it now, but we're not going to stand in your way. And subsequently, they've told us we're not going to be doing the testing. So had an opportunity.
Look at it from a firefighter standpoint. They're looking at it from a manufacturer standpoint, and they're trying to weigh the cost versus gain. And the testing is going to show, as we all know, that the fuel from the glue is a contributing factor for, you know, rapid fire spread in that void space, also for premature failure of the sheetrock, which is a built-in engineered component of fire safety from compartment spread from room to room, and a life safety factor. So, you know, I commend you guys for working on the glue side of things, because that is a huge contributing factor when you look at the amount of overspray. And we've got a few pictures on there to show people with the amount of overspray.
The overspray, those photos are from a home in the Worcester area of Massachusetts that, you know, it was litigated. There was some concerns. There were many quality concerns, but it allowed that the building be gutted. And we had the opportunity in that gutting process to go in there with camera in tow, and we were stunned. You know, all that overspray, that's just not necessary. The manufacturer's recommendations for a small bead, I think it's like an inch and a quarter high, an inch and three quarters wide, and that's it. That's all you need of this flammable product to do what it's supposed to do.
Right.
And, you know, my father told me never buy a car on a Monday because the guys were – that was built on a Monday because the guys were hungover from the weekend. And, you know, when you see copious amounts of glue sprayed on the roof rafters in the attic, you know, this isn't holding up anything.
Yeah.
The overspray pooling like you see in some of these pictures in one of the bays in the attic. There's just no need for that, and it goes back to the whole quality assurance program. But my concern, you know, irrelevant of how it got there, all that unnecessary glue is additional BTUs.
Yeah.
When it burns, we know that is going to generate a great deal of heat energy. It's going to release, you know, thick toxic smoke, and it's just going to, you know, further challenge what's already a challenging environment for our guys to go into.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm still very concerned that the industry is kind of punted on the doing the testing. I would love for NIST to take a hold of this. You know, I was watching the FDNY video that National Fallen Firefighters Foundation just put out
for the wind-driven fires.
Wonderful. You know, they're doing some great stuff, and you know, I I teach a class in building construction, and we look at the Station Nightclub fire, and NIST did a wonderful job of recreating the stage. You know, we know what happened without being there based upon the science. And with the thousands and thousands and thousands of modular homes that are out there currently, and those that are coming, and companies that are just kind of shrugging off our concerns and continuing to build the way that they traditionally have always built, you know, to me, this just screams for NIST or another reputable independent research facility to step up and say, you know, let's slow this down a little bit, take a look, prove, you know, the guys in Massachusetts wrong. You know, I would love for somebody to shut me up on this. Honestly, there's no pleasure in this taking punches at an industry. But at the same time, I would hope that they would have a high concern for us.
Yeah,
you know,
it's our brothers.
Exactly. Not only, you know, first and foremost, for the people that they're selling the product to. I asked one guy if he would, you know, if you purchase a home, an existing home, at least in the Commonwealth, and that's all I want to speak for, you have to sign a disclaimer that your house either does or does not have lead paint. And I said to the guy, how about putting out a disclaimer that as a purchaser of a modular home that's using polyurethane foam structural adhesive that burns quick, hot, and fast, and that's the only thing that's holding up the ceiling, how about letting me know that before I give you my down payment?
Absolutely.
You just get the blank stare, like, you know, go away, young guy.
Yeah.
Go back to pushing it and make golf balls, you know.
So
but
Chief, we've been going like 90 minutes.
Yes,
we didn't get like halfway through this yet.
So, that happens to me down in FDIC.
I know.
They have these wonderful kids from, I think it's the University of Kentucky that sit
monitor.
In the classes. They kind of, the moderator. And I always tell one of them, you're my timekeeper. You need to jump up 10 minutes before schedule to end and shut me up.
So I don't want to cut any of this important material out. So we got a little time left. So let's pick up. We covered voids, we covered the glue, but we didn't cover all the voids. And there's some unique voids that let's just quickly browse over so when people look at them that they can understand what they're looking at. So let's look at, like, the hoisting and where they make a void to create the cable. You know, just talk for just a couple minutes about that, like, for hoisting.
The crane access lifting holes, these are made in the factory. And my understanding is that their positioning at the bottom of each box is dependent upon the overall weight of the box.
Yep.
So it arrives on, in your backyard on a flatbed. We still have to get it from the flatbed onto the foundation, and then the second floor box is on top of the first floor. So it is not uncommon for a cable to be run through these holes, formed into a sling, and used by a crane to put these in place. Other methods are just the sling itself that would go under the sill and lift them. But the crane access lifting holes came into play in my fire here in Acushnet. What we've got to be concerned about is that these line up perfectly with the void space.
Right.
You know, the boxes are laid on top of each other. Shipped with the units is what is referred to as a belly band. And it's a series of materials that are used to cover the point where the top box and the bottom box marry. So you secure that and you cover the holes. And then usually the vinyl siding, you know, the wrap goes on and then the vinyl siding on top of that. So, you know, if the set crew is on their game, they're going to make sure that those crane access lifting holes are covered.
They need
to be covered. Because if not, then an external fire could communicate easily through that hole right into the void space. And now what do we know about the void space? It's large, it's filled with air, it's filled with wood, and it's filled with an accelerant in most cases, being the glue that's used. In our fire, it was clear that certain shortcuts were taken, and when that roof was... the farmer's porch was added. There was recessed lights in the roof. And the way we believe that the power supply was provided to those lights was running the wires through that crane access lifting hole and tapping into the power supply on the inside of the house.
Yep.
So then when the cigarette started, the window box, and the window box dotted the vinyl siding and ultimately the roof, it was just an easy path into the void space.
Yeah.
And I am firmly convinced, if we go back to where we were 89 minutes ago and we talked about, you know, the woman in the home that January night feeling the increased sensation of heat, we believe that two things were going on. First and foremost, it was a fire burning underneath her in the void space. It had to be, simply
yeah.
by the amount of volume of fire when they exited. It got in through that hole, and it was in the void space. And at the same time, it ran up the vinyl siding, through the vinyl soffit, into the attic. And
above and below.
So they had, you know, they were sandwiched by fire for a period of time. They got out, thankfully, and then that photograph from B-side with the cars in the driveway where we saw fire left, right, up, down, equally distributed. The ceiling on the second floor and the ceiling on the first floor had to fail, and it just dropped the products of combustion down to the floor below, and it just ate everything in its path. That's
yeah.
the house simply imploded based on the fire burning in the void space and
yeah.
in the attic. And I'm sure that there's fire science engineers that will challenge us on that. You know, the industry folks will challenge us on that. But as the person standing in the middle of the street watching this fire and seeing how quickly this two-story home burned to the ground, and given these different construction techniques that we now know, worst-case scenario for each and every one of them. You know, this was a classic failure of several systems. Had it just been one, you know, we might have had a chance at stopping the fire. But all of these things came into play: the void space, the glue, the crane access, lifting holes,
dominoes.
Absolutely, the lightweight construction materials. All of it, just like you said, it was a domino.
Yeah.
And it's just something that, knowing what we know now, should probably have expected it to act the way that it did.
Okay. So we're not going to get through all of the unique building features, hazards that we have, but let's move in full circle now and talk a little bit about tactics. You and I have had a discussion about identifying modular homes so that the brothers, like I said, in the battle, the guys that are side by side going in to take care of this fire, they can identify the building and communicate it to the command, and things that the incident commander can potentially do to identify. Now, me having some insight as well in this, is the first thing that I can identify from an exterior 360 is, oftentimes, because the additional void space between the first floor and the second floor, due to the way the boxes are designed, that there's greater surface mass of the front of side A above the first floor windows to the sill of the second floor windows. They just don't look right compared to a stick-built home where they pretty much are evenly spaced out between the ground and the soffit on the roof line. So I found this in ladder company classes that I've taught. If you have a home set back and has the slightest bit of grade, and people have 9-foot ceilings in the first floor, and they have 2x10 or 2x12 floor joist construction, and they choose to have a high ceiling on the second floor, that your 24-foot ladder won't reach the second floor window or won't reach the sill if you have it set at the proper angle. Because the additional height, these houses are a little bit taller than a traditional stick-built home due to the fact these additional void spaces. So that's the first thing I identify when I'm looking at a house as I'm walking up doing a profile of the building. The second thing that I can tell brothers is when you go inside, situational awareness is everything. Can't stress it enough, is when I make entry into the home, in part of my benchmarking process that I teach out at FDIC, I have a strong, strong format for interior benchmarking, which is situational awareness, where I am exactly, how much air did it take me to get there, what do I see, what do I feel, what do I hear, 5 questions that run through my head every time I change floors, every time I locate the fire or I locate a victim. I'm constantly doing this benchmarking process so that I can use that information to then compared to the last time. So if I have rapid fire increase all of a sudden because I have fire that's running underneath the void, I can identify that 2 minutes ago when I did my last benchmark in my head, it wasn't as hot. So I'm stepping through. But one of the things of what do I see, I work my way immediately at every building fire to the marriage wall, the center wall of a Cape or a Colonial. I work my way to the center wall, which is dividing either the front box to the rear box or living room to the dining room or kitchen to the dining room, depending upon how the floor is laid out. And in the center wall, the marriage wall, because the boxes are 2x6 constructed walls, when you match those two boxes up, you know, 2x6s are 5 1/4 dimensionally after they're trimmed out. They call them 2x6s. So you have 10.5 inches of actual framing, and then that framing has to be trimmed out. So the 10.5, you add some framing on there, 3/4 inch on the front, and you add a couple half-inch trim moldings on each side. You're looking at 12 inches of mass of the center marriage wall that divides the front to the back of the house. Now, those are oftentimes open arches. Sometimes they have doors to close off, maybe French doors from the living room, dining room, something like that. But if they're open, I put my hand on it. And if I can't take my hand and wrap it around the entire trim, molded trim of that center marriage wall, it's a red flag that I'm in a building that's 2x6 walls on the center wall. Now, a stick-built home, they're not putting two 2x6s to put that center wall up. They're going to use a 2x6, or they might even use a 2x4 if it's not weight, non-weight-bearing, depending upon the dimensional lumber that they're using for, engineered lumber that they're using for the span. So that's the first indicator I can come up with. Interior, zero visibility, you know, mask on the floor, mask on the wall, and I can tell the chief, you know, command from Division 1, we're at the center of, the AD side, I'm at the marriage wall, and I got 12 inches of mold, and I think we're in a modular home. But I'm thinking in my head, I'm in a balloon frame home, because we have now just told everybody that it's a balloon frame home laying on the side. And then the next thing is, if you have a fire on the second floor, you can see the molding, obviously, as you walk in, because you're not going to have a smoke condition on the first, potentially. But as the second dew crew comes in or the third dew crew comes in to do ventilation, go immediately to the kitchen sink and open up the cabinet underneath the sink and look and see if it actually has the big sticker on it for the third-party inspection evaluation, certifying that that building is to the code for a modular home. And you can, if you do have a concern that you can't clearly identify the marriage wall, you can immediately go to that. So there's three things immediately right off the top of my head that I can provide to the brothers out there that you can identify with greater situational awareness of where you are. And then if you know you're in a modular home, we have to do what? We have to do what with the clock, Chief?
Oh, reduce it by magnitudes. You know, every officer, every incident commander, every firefighter should be keeping an eye on the clock of when the fire got into that structure. You know, not so much when the fire started on the couch, but when the fire breached the ceiling or breached the wall. That's where we really need to be concerned, because that's what gets us into a world of hurt.
Right.
That's when a room and contents fire then becomes a true structure fire.
And I'm a huge proponent of a dispatcher having certain terminology, if you have control of your dispatchers, to say that the report is we have fire inside the building, which means that the caller said, I got, you know, a living room, I got a sofa, I got a bed on fire, I can see fire. Now, if a caller is passing by and they're reporting that they see fire coming out of a window of a dwelling that they're passing by and they're not on the inside, or they have fire coming through the roof, then that dispatcher could dispatch that with a few different words for a reported structure fire. The word structure fire, i.e. being that the dwelling's structural support system is currently being degraded by fire. And the incident commanders can adopt this in policy as well from the street, that, you know, when he signs off, you know, we're going offensive attack for room and contents or an interior fire in the building, or we're signing off, I'm marginal mode, we're stretching a line to protect the life safety, we're going to the second floor for a quick search of 5 a.m., possibly people sleeping, of a fire inside the building. And then as he starts to think, geez, you know, things are not adding up here and the fire's getting bigger and I'm not seeing the progression from the advancement of the first line or the second line, that he can then say, dispatch from command on a 20-minute this is my 20-minute update or my 15-minute update, that I'm now reporting that we got, you know, 30x40 structure fire and we're going into a defensive mode because we've completed our primary and we're moving from the marginal mode back to a defensive operation. These buildings are going to burn fast. They're burning in areas of the dwelling that firefighters are not suspecting that they have fire under them or above them.
Billy, I like the idea, and you know, it's common in many areas, but uncommon in many others, of dispatch giving command an update on how long has passed since receipt of the call. And if I'm standing in the street and dispatch calls me and says, you know, command, 10 minutes since receipt of the call. You know, the call didn't come in prior to the fire. The fire was going when the call was made. Don't know how much time went on prior to the receipt of the call.
Right.
But how important would it be to know that it's been 15, 20, 25 minutes since the call was received?
Right.
And I'm not making any headway here.
No, our dispatch center has a timer. And when the timer counts down every 20 minutes, then the bell goes off. Command from dispatch, this is your first 20-minute par check. This is your second minute 20 par check. When you're at 3-4 hours, man, you're going through an awful lot of par checks when you have long incidents.
Absolutely.
But I tell you what, it's all about firefighter safety.
Absolutely. And here's one other piece of firefighter safety. I love the ideas that you came up with. And I've been teaching at FDIC for 3 years now, this course, this basic hazards course. And I'm remodeling it to be more tactics and strategy based moving forward. And you know, what you came up with, I think, was brilliant. Grab that molding, and it shouldn't be as large as it is among the marriage walls. Perfect indicator that it's a module, one I hadn't thought of. But most simply, and something that, you know, firefighters can do, company officers, definitely chief level officers should be doing, is pre-planning. And you know, we don't expect a homeowner to come knocking on the chief's door and saying, hey, hi, I built a module. You might want to come take pictures of it, or here's the address so that you can revise your tactics. But what's important to remember is that there's a hook within every state that you can play here. Because these buildings are inspected outside of your state and shipped to your state, the point of contact is some government entity within the state government. In Massachusetts, it's the Department of Public Safety. In New Hampshire, it's the State Fire Marshal's Office. Every modular that comes in has to send in data on that particular module, that particular home, including the address. So if I'm in Alabama or if I'm in South Carolina or if I'm in New Hampshire and I'm in my hometown and I want to know what modular homes are there to add to my dispatch database, I can make a phone call, I can send an email, or I can write a letter the old-fashioned way to my point of contact within the state and ask for that information. We did that, and we matched that up with the documents that we had in our local building official's office. We don't have a very sophisticated dispatch center here in our community of 11,000, but what we did when, you know, the police department handles the dispatching for us, you know, they now have, when they start a call for service and plug in the address on their computerized form, if that's been predetermined to be a modular, then in big red bold letters on the notes, it says modular construction, notify the fire department.
Mm.
So, you know, it says computer-aided dispatch as we're going to get until times get better.
You just created more work for my department.
Yeah.
We have MDTs in every truck and every command vehicle, and I have a high hazard you know, risk assessment alert on my MDT, and it oftentimes has high hazards, you know, past incidents there. It has handicapped people or people that are unable to egress on their own. It could be, you know, very sick people or children that are hospital ridden, mm-hmm. like with a bed. And that changes from time to time depending upon when we locate and find things. But that, you know, that's just something else that I don't think I even had heard of before, was gaining that information from your local state agency. Ours being the State Fire Marshal's Office, we have plenty of friends there. We'll definitely get that information.
And it's simply knowing before you get there, because I defy anyone at 2 a.m. And, you know, the standing outside of a home to make that important decision on, are you going to modify your tactics because you know that this is a modular? And we simply don't. You know, we just you know, walk into battle, walk into our battleground thinking that it's a, you know, a traditionally stick-built home.
Right.
And shame on us if the information is simply an email or a phone call away. Because, like you said, let's kind of peel back the layers of the onion here. That room and contents fire, that sofa that's burning, 482 degrees generated at the ceiling level and passing through to the glue above starts the decomposition. It loses its adhesiveness. It puckers. It doesn't need to fall. And it doesn't need to be a large portion of the sheetrock that collapses. All it needs to do is create a small gap.
Void.
And those flames are now into that void space where there's plenty of air, there's plenty of fuel, and like we said, there's an accelerant.
Yeah.
And now it's burning further down. It's preheating the structural members. It's loosening the glue, further down. And now we should be expecting ceiling collapse a lot sooner than if it were a traditionally built home where the sheetrock is screwed into place and the only thing above that fire is a bay created by the joists.
Right.
So, there's a lot of information that, as an incident commander sending folks in, I want to know, particularly if it's a modular. There's marriage walls and gaps in marriage walls between the front and the rear boxes of both levels, where the fire penetrates into that. You have a fire, running within the partition walls.
Yep.
There's the way that they lay the electrical system out is different than what we're used to in stick-built homes.
Right. In the marriage wall thing, I just want to make a quick point because we're running short on time, is for you guys that are going out and doing pre-planning as buildings are being built, if you see a foundation laying on the ground and you find out from your building department, from permitting, that that's going to be a modular, stop in there. Oftentimes those lots are sitting empty waiting for the prefab to come. And when they set these, if the foundation's out of square, it creates a greater gap in that marriage wall, and there's a huge void there, ballooned not only what we talked about earlier about horizontally, but if we set a box, two perfectly square boxes on an unsquare foundation, they oftentimes will pull the box to the front leading edge of the foundation so that when you're standing on the front lawn looking at the house, you don't see a shelf of concrete sticking out. And they don't squish the two marriage walls together, and it creates a void in the center. When they pull the boxes out to flush them out to the exterior of the foundation, it creates a void in the center, and it creates a huge void on the gable end, on the end that they choose to not square up. And they cover it over, oftentimes, with either the paper or the wrap, or they just vinyl side the thing quick so that no one sees it. The homeowner might not necessarily be GC in his own home. Now we actually have an exterior fire where it easily gains entry to the center marriage wall, which potentially could have 1-2-inch gap that runs horizontally and laterally all the way to the attic. So not only do we have a balloon frame home on the ground laying sideways, we have a balloon frame home going straight up and down. And that's all due to the fact that, like you mentioned earlier, Chief, that the inspectors don't have to come out nearly as many times to keep the construction crew on task as a stick-built home. And if you're a firefighter and they're craning, just stop in and shoot, say hi. Is it okay to look at what you guys are doing? And just take a look. Pay attention before they wrap that thing. And if you got any concern, go see the chief and then get the ball rolling in the inspection side of things just to have someone come out and take a peek at it. Because this is what's going to keep firefighters educated, experienced, and have the know-how to make decisions when we do have the fire at 2 in the morning.
I have a modular going up in my community on Friday, and the building commissioner and I will, barring any restraining orders, will be spending some time out there just observing, taking pictures, adding to our, mental database of what we know and see, if there's anything new that's happening. These, like I said earlier, to me, prior to the fire, it was the foundation one day, the house the next. Didn't really have a real good handle on what modular construction was all about. Was forced to because, when you stand there and watch someone's home burn to the ground within minutes and everything that they own. And like I mentioned before, this is a community of 11,000 people. If you don't know the person directly, you know somebody who knows them.
Yeah.
And we just needed to find the answer as to whether or not was this of our doing or were there forces here greater than us.
Well, I commend you on that, Chief, because, you know, what you've put together is incredible training package. And, you know, I'm sure this is going to spur some people wanting to know how to get more information from you, how to get in contact with you, and potentially, you know, how to have you come out and do some training or some education for them. So what's the best way for people to actually make contact with you?
I am a thoroughly modern man. I have completely given myself up to email. Resisted it for several years, but I am now a devotee of email. So you can send me an email to chief@acushnetfire, one word, spelled acushnetfire.com, or, because of my wife, I am also on Facebook, which I still get embarrassed saying publicly. But Kevin Gallagher, plug in Kevin Gallagher, Acushnet Fire, and I'll probably pop up there. So, or call the fire station. You know, you can look us up online, and be more than happy to hear from anyone if anyone has any experiences. One of our frustrations is that there's no coordinated data collection point. You know, we use MFIRS, the Massachusetts Fire Incident Reporting System here in the state, that then reports to NFIRS.
Yep.
We have to let the federal government know whether or not smoke detectors were sounding, but we don't let them know what the construction of the building that burned that caused the smoke detector to sound was. So, you know, when we asked whether or not this was a trend within modular construction, nobody has the data to be able to say yes. It's classified as a wood frame structure.
Yeah.
So we're unable to drill into the subsets. So we do an internet search, and, you know, your search engines, you plug in certain code words, and there's not a week that goes by where there's not a report of a modular fire. Now, here's where we need to be careful. A lot of those get reported by the media when they're indeed the manufactured homes,
right?
The chassis, the HUD-controlled mobile home.
Yep.
So you need to be careful when you do those internet searches that you're actually looking at, you know, what we've been talking
right
about
data.
Here. Yeah. And the to me, there needs to be some formal way of kind of collecting that data. Because otherwise,
that comes down the road.
It's all, you know, anecdotal, and, you know, the industry will push back, and you know, that hurts us, I think. It hurts us as an industry not to be able to quantify with certainty that there's this trend. But what's very interesting, when it's a wood frame true modular home that's burned, usually there's a fire officer who will say this home was burning it fully involved by the time we got there.
Yeah, so fast.
Or, exactly. You know, there are always comments about the speed in which the fire owned the building,
yep.
That it was fully involved by the time they rolled up. And there was just one I saw, I think it was in Tennessee, where the fire chief said in the newspaper, well, everyone knows that modular homes burn fast. And I thought, well, we're getting there. We're getting there. We want everybody to know that, again, they're not, you know, they can be a quality product. It's just that there's certain construction techniques that are new
right.
to us that the guys need to know about. And here's what I would love. I'll talk about dominoes. This is what I want. I want the firefighters, the guys on the nozzle, backing them up, running the pump, to say, whoa, this is a big deal. Hey, Lieutenant. Hey, Captain. What are we doing about this? And the line officers then turn to the chiefs and say, listen, we want to know collectively, what are we doing about this? And the chiefs turn to, you know, the code developers in the industry and say, hey, what are you doing about this?
Yeah.
We all have, you know, a horse in this race. And I think it needs to come, it needs to be from all levels. This can't be driven by brass alone. It's got to be driven by the firefighters. And
yep.
And I would love for, you know, the associations. We got great support from the Call Volunteer Firefighters Association in Massachusetts when we went with the mechanical fasteners proposal.
Yep.
You know, down the road, we'd love to have a marriage between, you know, that group and the PFFM, the Professional Firefighters of the State, the IAFF. There's interest, you know, there's several leaders across the state, across the country, Sean DeCrane being one of them from Ohio, who's a great guy. He is the person responsible. We need to thank him for the floor protection code change that is going to be found in the 2012 IRC. That was his baby. You know, he'll say it was a team effort, but he was the driving force behind that. And, you know, I share this information with him, and he scratches his head. You've got to be kidding me. You know, let's get one thing at a time.
One battle at a time.
Exactly, exactly. So that's where we are. And you know, this has been a great opportunity, I think, to speak in a very comfortable format, and I want to thank you for that. And, you know, with the enhancements of some of the slides, get the message across that this is real. This isn't make-believe. You more than likely have modular homes in your community. Hopefully you know where they are. If you don't, you will. I get phone calls because of, you know, I've kind of upped my profile a little bit locally here from folks in my community and surrounding communities say, hey, I have a modular home. You know, why are you scaring me? And, you know, my response to folks is, you know, they're not bad. They can be quality homes, and you should be very proud and happy to have one. However, you need to know that if there is a fire, you need to probably act a little quicker. You need to have a real good evacuation plan, accountability plan. You need to make sure your alarm systems are working. And as long as you do that, like anyone in any type of constructed home in which we, you know, sleep at night and put our kids to bed, we want to make sure that all those systems are working so that if there is a fire, you know, we can get out and make notification. The fire department can come and do their thing. But with modular homes, you know, they're not inherently unsafe, but when they burn differently. And that's the message that I think we need to make sure that folks understand. This is not your grandfather's, you know, stick-built home.
Right.
This is modern. It is, you know,
Engineered.
You know, one of the fire industry leaders that I spoke to about this down at FDIC last year said to me, you know, this is a huff and puff and blow your house down. I can't believe that they're being built with wooden and glue.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, we should have seen this coming. Should have seen this coming because the construction techniques are moving so fast that, you know, we're several steps behind. And hopefully we're able to close that gap.
Well, hopefully this show will help assist that. We'll get some people thinking and potentially reaching out for more help or more education on it and supporting the cause because, like you said, we need a collaborated effort for everyone to make sure that this and the codes that are to come in the future are greatly enhancing our firefighter safety as well as the occupants and the life safety hazards that are involved in this. So, Chief, you know, I got to wrap it up. We've gone for a couple hours. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you calling in and talking to us. You know, once again, from everybody here at Tap the Box and FETC Services, I just want to extend a sincere thank you for calling in tonight.
It was my pleasure, and it indeed was a lot of fun. I appreciate this this venue. You made it very comfortable, and I think our message got through, and hopefully if, you know, one person learned one thing, then we're successful.
Very good. Very good. Well, I'll be in touch with you soon, and you guys have a good night and be safe.
Very good, Billy. Thank you. Thank you very
much. All right, Chief. Have a good night.
Take care.
Well, there you have it. Chief Gallagher from the Acushnet, Mass. Fire Department. He was on tonight to talk about hidden hazards of modular construction. And we had a great discussion. Hopefully you guys learned a lot tonight in regards to building construction. Some of this stuff might look like a stick-built house, but it's definitely not. So, you know, look at our Facebook page. Go to Facebook and look at FETC Services. And on there we have a folder for hidden hazards of modular construction with some good photos. Listen to the podcast. Look at the photos. Make contact with Chief Gallagher. And, you know, pick his brain. If you've had incidents and you've had things happen to guys or to other departments around you, reach out to him. Let him know because he's building a tactics portion of this now that he's going to take on the road to try to provide greater firefighter safety and situational awareness. So with that said, we're going to go to closing out the show tonight. This is Tap the Box. It's the creation and sole opinion of the show's owner, me, Billy Greenwood of FETC Services. All rights reserved and all personal opinions expressed or implied are just that, personal opinion of me, the show's owner, and not that of Fire Engineering Training Blog Network, the Penwell Corporation, or any agency, association, or fire department or organization for which I'm associated with. Same thing goes for my guests as well. With that said, Tap the Box and FETC Services would like to say thank you to Chief Gallagher from the Acushnet Mass Fire Department for calling in tonight and providing us with an in-detailed look of hidden hazards of modular construction. Stay tuned, listeners, for our next show. It's going to be on July 11th, 2012. And with that said, Tap the Box would like to end the show, as we always do, with this one passing thought. A great man once said early into my career to remember to say I love you to the ones that you love each and every time that you leave to start a new tour. May God watch over the brother and sisterhood tonight who are currently protecting our citizens. God bless the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Without your commitment and dedication to protecting our freedom, we would not be able to produce such a show. When you see a soldier or a veteran in passing, reach out, shake his or her hand, and tell them thank you for serving. God bless the USA. This is Tap the Box, and we're out of here. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.